proceed to the fourth case of the day, Private Bank Trust versus Progressive. Mr. Orlovsky?
May it please the court, Mr. Orlovsky on behalf of the plaintiff appellant Private Bank and Trust Company. There are two issues in this insurance coverage case. First, whether this claim is covered under the policy, and that turns on the language, did this loss result directly from acts of false pretenses committed on the premises of the bank? And secondly, if it's covered, is it nonetheless barred by the exclusion for losses that are the result of erroneous deposits? Let me turn to the first clause, whether this is covered under the false pretenses coverage of the policy. And I think this is really an issue that there is no court opinion directly on. We've got acts of false pretenses. They caused a loss, but some of them occurred on the premises, some of them occurred off the premises. I can't deny that at least one act in this fraudulent scheme occurred off the premises, and that was the telephone call asking to withdraw money. So we've got to look at the policy here. But I think the parties in the court actually agreed on a lot. We only diverged in one small respect and came to different results. I think everybody acknowledges that this is a causation test. The policy says that the loss must result directly from these acts of false pretenses, and this is a test of causation. The false pretenses must cause this loss. The precise contours of exactly what sort of causation standard it is has led to some disagreement among the courts, some courts saying it's proximate cause, the Illinois Appellate Court recently saying it's a little more than proximate cause. But I don't think we really have to get into the esoteric question of exactly what the nature of the causation standard is, because no one disagrees under any standard that the perpetrator's conduct caused loss to the bank, under any standard. The problem is different. The problem is, what do we do when some of the acts were on the premises and some of the acts were off the premises?
You agree that if, instead of making a telephone call after these checks cleared, Goodman would have walked into the bank and said, transfer this money, $400,000, to this other person's account. If you would have walked in, that would have satisfied the on-premises portion. Now, you still have the exception you can argue about, but you agree that would have taken that issue right out of the case.
Well, I think that would be the carrier would probably agree to that. That I don't think we'd be here.
Well, the carrier would agree.
I think there's no question. They would agree that if that took place on the premises, then there'd be no argument.
Okay. And your position essentially is that we shouldn't break this scheme up into little pieces. We should look at it as just one scheme, and enough of it happened on the premises, so we satisfy that.
I think that's right, and maybe I can articulate it this way. I think that if you can say that the loss was more the result of acts that took place on the premises than what took place off the premises, then you've satisfied the policy's requirement that the loss be a direct result of acts that took place on the premises.
Okay.
In other words, what we've got to do is we've got to look at the gist of the scheme, the essential things of it. And I want to think one thing is important. No one contends that every act in the scheme has to take place on the premises. In fact, in the appellant's brief, they make that statement exactly in a footnote. We have made the point at one point that that was one possible reading of the policy, and we didn't think it was right. And at page 20 of their brief, in footnote 5, if you allow me to put my glasses on, they say that another twist on this conceptual framework proposed by Private Bank is the possible reading that the bond requires every single act of the fraudulent scheme to take place on the premises. The bond does no such thing. That's what the insurance company says. The insurance company agrees that not every act of the fraudulent scheme has to take place on the premises. So what everybody is really doing here is trying to find what was the key act in the scheme. Where did the gravamen of this scheme really take place? Was it really an on-premises scheme with some minor acts off the premises? Or was it really an off-premises scheme with some minor acts taking place on the premises? We diverge when we look at the facts. What the insurance company and the trial court said is the key fact in this scheme was the telephone call. And we say, no, that was not the key fact. The key fact was what took place on the bank's premises. They did 95% of the work of the fraud on those premises. They got to open an account, deposit checks, and all they had to do was reap the fruits of their labor a couple of days later. The reason the trial court and the insurance company seized on that phone call is they say the loss didn't occur until funds were withdrawn. And that's right. But that's not a causation analysis. Causation doesn't turn on the happenstance of where the act that triggers the loss happens to occur. If you build a house with a shoddy foundation and someone comes along and gives it a little nudge, the triggering act of the loss is the nudge given to the house. But under any causation analysis, the real cause of that was the shoddy foundation that was built. A causation analysis requires you to see what really brought about this result. What were the real facts that brought about this result?
Those are liability concepts, though. We're talking about insurance coverage here. And so if you would identify the language of the insurance policy that controls and how that should be interpreted, perhaps we'd be more on track.
I think that's right. The reason I'm using liability concepts is because I believe the policy gives us a causation standard, and that's what we have to look to. But the exact language of the policy is, this loss must result directly from acts that occurred for false pretenses on the premises. And I think, as long as you accept the fact that not every act has to occur on the premises, what resulting directly means is what occurred on the premises must be closely and directly related from a causation standpoint to the loss.
Okay, now I've heard you articulate three different tests for this insurance policy clause. Mm-hmm. One was, the first one you started out with was that if the loss was the result of acts that occurred more on the premises than off the premises, then it's within the coverage grant. And then I heard you say that if the key act of the scheme occurred on the premises, then it's within the coverage grant. And now I'm hearing you say a different test or articulate a different test, that if it's closely related?
Well, my view is the proper test, the best articulation I can make of it, is the first one, that coverage should be allowed if the loss is more the result of acts that occur on the premises than off the premises.
How much more? 51%?
Well, the reason I articulated it differently, because we have an easier case here. We have such a dominant set of facts that occurred on the premises. But in my view, ultimately the test should be, I think 51% would be enough. Because
shouldn't we focus on the act that actually caused the loss? Isn't that how the policy language reads?
Yes, but cause does not mean triggers the loss. That last phone call did trigger the loss, but that's not the cause. That's not what caused that loss to occur. Resulting directly, I'm using the word cause because we've given some dictionary definitions. I think they're essentially equivalent terms. What results and what brings about this loss is not in any real sense that last phone call. That's simply what causes it. That's simply what triggers it. You don't have a loss before the funds are withdrawn. We concede that. But that's just a triggering event. That's not what really brought it about. As I say, all the work had been done before. So if you want to know what results in the loss, you've got to look from a factual point of view for what events, what acts really brought about that result. What made it happen? Now, I know I'm using different words there, but they're really just different words for the word cause. And I should say that all of the courts that have struggled with this language have all struggled with it as a cause test. Some have said it's proximate cause. Some have said direct it is more. But they all use cause because it's a term we're more familiar with. But if you use the word result directly, as long as it more resulted from acts that occurred on the premises than off, I think that language is satisfied. And I think perhaps the best illustration is just flip it around. What if the person did everything off the premises, did this by computer, by the internet, and then walked onto the premises and said, give me my money? Under the theory adopted by the district court, that claim would be covered because that's the triggering act. And I suggest that completely goes contrary to the intent of this policy, which is to not cover remotely committed frauds, but cover face-to-face frauds. And you'd really have very arbitrary results depending upon whether that final triggering act was on or off the premises. I don't think that's consistent with the intent of this policy.
All right. You want to reserve some time, Mr. Rolos?
I suppose. I didn't get to the second part of it, the second clause, but I'll reserve it.
It's your time. You choose to do it the way you...
I'll reserve for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rossi. Mr. Silk?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Silk. I am representing Progressive Casualty Company. There is one point on which we agree. I think the primary question here is whether the bank's loss resulted directly from a false pretense committed on the bank's premises.
But why isn't it a fair way to look at it, as counsel just said, that this is a a scheme to bilk the bank out of money. And 98% of this was done on premises, face to face, showing the articles of incorporation, and everything had to do to open that account. And once that account was opened and the checks cleared, it was just a matter of time before that money was going to be built from the bank. And that is the on-premise, that's enough to satisfy the on-premises requirement of the policy.
No, no matter how much I think so, I will not make the mistake of saying that's a good question. I will try to give you a good answer. I think there are two basic points I would make about that. First is looking to this court's previous decisions in Alpine State Bank and Bradley Bank, where this court stated quite clearly, merely accepting the deposits, even if the customer is present in the bank, that does not irrevocably commit the bank to allowing the withdrawals from the account. There is no loss at that point. Well, nothing is set in stone.
It seems to me it's so much harder to do what Goodman did in setting this account up. That's very difficult. It took a lot of planning. Pretty shrewd operator here. This telephone call was peanuts here, and the big picture of what happened.
Well, I think there is one fact here which illustrates just how important the request to transfer the funds from the account was. The deposit to the account was for $461,000.
Right.
The bank's claimed loss is just $400,000. The $400,000 that he requested by phone be transferred out of the account. What about the other $61,000 which he deposited to the account?
Well, didn't he come back? That's how he got arrested. Didn't he come back and try to get
I
got greedy?
I think that's a critical point here. That money remained in the account. I mean, until that request for transfer is made and executed, the fraud could be discovered, and there might not be any loss, regardless of any false pretense that may have been made at the time of the deposit. And that is, in part, what happened here. Although $461,000 was deposited, the $61,000 remained in the account, and there is no loss with respect to that portion of the deposit. Because before he was able to try and withdraw those funds, it was discovered. That loss never occurred.
It would have been, I would think, impossible for him to have opened this account and satisfied all the bank's requirements here of seeing this identification and so on. It would have been impossible to do that on the telephone. He had to be in the bank to do that. Am I wrong on that?
I'm not sure I can answer that. I don't know.
Well, if the banks, we want to see all these things.
Right.
We want to see your picture. He didn't show his driver's license with his picture on it.
Right.
And a phony name. It just seems to me that that to break this up and say it's only the telephone call, we have to only focus on the telephone call, could not have been within the contemplation of the parties by when they talked about this on-premises requirement in the bonds. In the bond.
Well, respectfully, I think that it does, because it is the indispensable portion. I don't think it can be, if there were 100 acts and this was one, I don't think we could say that this represents 1% of the fraudulent activity.
But you agree if he would have come into the bank after the checks cleared and just walked up to a teller and said, transfer $400,000 of this account that has $460 in it to Beck's account, that the bank would have done that?
I think that insofar as the insuring agreement itself is concerned, the on-premises insuring clause in the bond, that would have been satisfied by his being on the bank's premises and making that request. We would still have the question of whether the exclusion N in the policy would have included coverage.
I just think your best case, if you have one here, is on the exclusion, not on the premises, but I can't speak for the other.
What's the insured? I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
What's the insured's interest in this, or the policy behind the on-premises, Mr. Silk? What's the purpose of that from the insured's position?
I think that the operative principle here, and it runs through a number of provisions in this bond, is to it's the bond is not all things to all people on this. It is attempting to carefully delineate what it will cover. And when it comes to fraud of this type, that these things will happen, but to at least require that there be some face-to-face transaction, to require that person to come into the bank's premises and carry out this fraud face-to-face, and not because the dangers of conducting these transactions remotely, be it by telephone or by computer, are obviously significantly greater. I think an example in this instance is that when the perpetrator initially attempted to open this account at a different branch of the bank, he was shown the door based on his appearance.
So opening the account, you said.
Yes.
Which could have happened here.
So I think that...
So the insured position is it's a greater risk with the off-site connect, and therefore that, for example, might require a higher premium. I mean, I'm not familiar with the policy area here. Is it a higher premium if you don't have the on-premises provision?
Well, I
or
think
would it be? I guess I should ask you.
I can't speak to the pricing aspect of this product, but I do believe that generally the carriers would regard those risks, as they obviously would be multiples of scenarios, would be greater, and that at the very least for this to be covered, you've got to have this fraud carried out on the bank's premises, face to face, and not through any one of a number of remote means. And I think that thread runs through the bond's various provisions.
So it's fair to say that this policy is intended to cover losses associated with theft or theft by fraud committed by customers or employees on the premises against which the bank can have certain safeguards in effect to prevent those sorts of things from happening?
Yes, I would agree with that. Again, the point I would come back to on this is that when that deposit is made, as this court has ruled, there is not a loss at that point. What you have, putting it somewhat differently, is you have an opportunity for a loss to occur. It's not until that withdrawal, in this case a transfer, that it actually does occur. And any number of things can happen up until that point, as happened here in part. And fraud was discovered. $61,000 of that deposit never did result in a loss, notwithstanding any false pretense that might have been committed at the time of the deposit.
Before you sit down, we've heard a lot about the boring insurance issues in this case, but tell us about what really happened here. When this guy was arrested, was he prosecuted in federal court, bank fraud, what happened to the coins? This is necessary to decide the insurance coverage, but it's pretty damn interesting.
I too would like to know the answer to that. Perhaps counsel does. I don't know what the ultimate outcome
is. You don't know if he was
I know he
prosecuted?
Was arrested. I don't know what the outcome of that
I mean, if he
was
convicted and the coins were recovered, everybody would be able to go home here, wouldn't they?
Well, that's right. Progressive's position, of course, is that should be a matter that the bank is keenly interested in, but our coverage does not apply. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Silk. Mr. Orlovsky?
I'll make two quick points, and then I think I can give you a little more information. I think it's just important with respect to the first clause to make sure we distinguish between what constitutes the loss and what causes the loss. Counsel's arguments is correct when he says that a loss doesn't occur till the withdrawals took place. That's what constitutes the loss. We have to find out what caused it, what resulted directly in the loss. The only thing I do want to say about the exclusion, which I didn't argue, is I just asked the court this. When reviewing the evidence that the insurance company says shows that the bank made an error, please remember that under the exclusion, there are two things the bank has to prove, and it's their burden of proof under an exclusion. One, that the bank made an error, and two, that that error resulted directly or indirectly in this loss. That's another, in a sense, a causation standard. If we made an error in the paperwork, and had we not made that error, this fraud still would have occurred and we would have suffered the loss, that doesn't trigger the exclusion. They have to show both that we made some mistake here and that had we not made that mistake, this loss wouldn't have occurred. So it's the mistake that resulted directly or indirectly in this loss. I won't go through the evidence on that. And that's the end of my argument. I can tell the court this, Your Honor, that the person who came into the bank was actually the low-level person, not the real mastermind of the scheme. The coins that he purchased were passed along to the people who had really purchased it and never recovered. And when this poor fellow came back to get his $60,000, which was his payment, he was arrested. And I assume he pled guilty or was prosecuted.
Was this Beck guy who had the account at the bank in on the deal?
The fellow who came into the bank?
No. The money was transferred to somebody else.
Oh, yeah. This was a merchant in downtown Chicago that there's no evidence they were involved at all. They just sold some coins to someone.
How did they know that he had an account at the bank that could have been transferred to?
He called the bank and said, I need this money to go to this merchant. As a matter of pure coincidence, so far as we know, this merchant had an account at the same bank.
Oh, that was just a coincidence?
Yes. So instead of having to do any sort of other fancy transaction.
That's a heck of a coincidence.
As far as we know.
All the banks in Chicago. Yeah.
Of all the gin joints, you would have come into my
those suspicions I can't answer.
Okay.
Thank you.
Charlesky. Thanks to all counsel. Case is taken under advisement. The court will take a very brief recess before the next argument.